Given this atmosphere of hostility, I did not know what to expect when we met the Carters at the White House the morning after we arrived in Washington. I was intrigued by the down-to-earth simplicity that the Carters had brought to the White House. I respected Rosalynn Carter's pioneering role as a first lady who wanted to pursue serious projects of her own. They were obviously intelligent people with whom we shared similar concerns, if not similar priorities, for our respective countries. Our first encounter came at the welcoming ceremony at the White House, which was formal and precluded any personal interaction. Joining us at the event were Abdullah and Faisal, who were both attending school in the United States at the time. Afterward, the President and my husband met in the Oval Office, and I met with Mrs. Carter, Joan Mondale, the Vice President's wife, and various other wives of officials, Jordanian and American, in one of the White House sitting rooms. Conversation with Mrs. Carter did not come easily. She seemed quite detached and cool, quite a contrast to the hospitable welcome my husband and I had received on state visits to other countries. I did not know what to think. Although I was surprised by her distance, I realized that Mrs. Carter might be shy, perhaps painfully so. I still carried with me remnants of my acute childhood shyness, and I could easily understand a first lady feeling the same way. I had asked for some briefing papers on Mrs. Carter before going to the White House, so I was aware of her keen interest in mental health issues. When I started to make overtures to her about her work with the mentally disabled, she warmed up a little. But the ice was never completely broken. I did not know whether she was just a highly reserved individual, or was deliberately expressing the tension created by our different perspectives on Middle East policy. I suspected it was the latter. Understandably, Mrs. Carter was being supportive and protective of her husband, just as I would have been of mine. The closest connection I made with her was over Hamza. Probably the nicest moments we shared were when Rosalynn walked me from the White House over to Blair House, after our first meetings, to see the baby. She seemed to relax completely as she cooed to him, and we talked about our families and children in that cozy environment. Hamza had a soothing influence on his father as well. Hussein would often return to Blair House tense and discouraged. The king had always been such a steady friend to the United States, but this was one of those times when the leaders did not want to hear his point of view. They had their eyes on the prize, the Camp David Accords, and did not want anything to stand in the way of their success. After agonizing rounds at the White House, State Department, and Capitol Hill, my husband would come back to our room at Blair House and seek out our young son. He would take him in his arms, make funny faces, and play with him, all the while talking to him in a mixture of Arabic and English. Caring for Hamza delighted and refreshed him, reminding us of what the struggle was all about, and helping to keep everything in perspective. I agreed to give interviews to the press in Washington with the aim of bridging the gulf of misunderstanding deepened by Camp David. Naively, I assumed that I would be able to discuss substantive issues with the reporters who would interview me. It's not that I did not understand where my novelty lay. I was the youngest queen in the world and the only American-born queen, but I hoped to be taken as a credible voice with serious matters to discuss. Unfortunately, People magazine persisted in writing about my storybook romance and identified me as a former decorator for Royal Jordanian Airlines. The Washington Post dedicated a whole paragraph to an exaggerated description of what I wore on a tour of the National Gallery of Art. Perhaps I was being too sensitive, but with all this talk about my appearance, I felt my sense of purpose slipping away. It was gallant of President Carter to begin his toast at the state dinner at the White House by saying, "A lot of people have accused me of inviting their majesties to Washington just so we could have Queen Noor visit the White House," making an obvious reference to President Kennedy's speech in France about accompanying Jackie to Paris. I knew he meant to pay me a compliment with his remarks, and who would not want to be compared to Jackie Kennedy? However, I could not help but feel like a useless accessory. It was not until a luncheon in my honor the next day that I regained a sense of composure. Jane Muskie, the wife of the Secretary of State, hosted the lunch, at which I gave a brief but substantive toast about the importance of U.S.-Jordan relations. Afterward, Leila Sharaf noted that it was the first time that I had displayed my grasp of politics in a public forum, and that I should do it more often. Her encouragement boosted my confidence. While my husband and his delegation continued their talks with American officials, I carried out a separate mission to meet with Jack Valenti, the president of the Motion Picture Association of America. I hoped to explore ways that Hollywood might recognize the injustice of stereotyping Muslims and Arabs, and help us advocate for a more balanced and realistic portrayal. Anyone in the entertainment industry who reflected any sensitivity to Arab and Muslim cultures ran a great risk of becoming persona non grata to the studios. I remember watching the 1978 Academy Awards and being horrified by the near riots prompted by the presence of British actress Vanessa Redgrave. Though she was being honored with an Academy Award for Julia, a film in which she played a member of the anti-fascist underground fighting Nazi Germany, she was reviled at the awards ceremony by the Militant Jewish Defense League, JDL, for making The Palestinian, a documentary about the siege of a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon in 1976. The JDL even burned her image in effigy. Though none of the protesters in Los Angeles had likely seen the documentary, no major American network, not even the Public Broadcasting Service, dared air it. The anti-Arab, anti-Redgrave demonstration outside the auditorium had grown so violent that an LAPD SWAT team had to be called in to disperse the crowd. In my opinion, Vanessa Redgrave was a brave and sensitive woman, not a public enemy. It had been while she was filming Julia in Paris, I learned later, that she had met a young Palestinian couple and learned about the tragedy at Tel el-Zatr, a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. A right-wing Lebanese Christian militia, trained by Israel, had killed thousands of men, women, and children there in a 53-day siege. Redgrave was so incensed that she had sold her two houses in England to finance the project, hired a film crew and director, and gone to Lebanon to make the documentary. In the process, she had become a spokesperson for the Palestinian cause. I shall never forget her defiance toward the demonstrators in her acceptance speech for the Oscar. She said she would not be intimidated by a small bunch of Zionist hoodlums whose behavior is an insult to the stature of Jews all over the world. There had been some boos in the audience and some applause, but from then on she would be targeted by the JDL. Trying to put a human face on the plight of the Palestinians and presenting a counterpoint to the stereotypical depictions of Arabs and Muslims in the movies would become a theme of my married life. It was so upsetting to be watching a very entertaining film, feeling relaxed and even laughing out loud, and suddenly freeze up whenever an Arab character would be introduced. In the black-and-white dynamic of stereotyping, the media inevitably portrayed Arabs as terrorists or oil-rich gluttons, as religious fanatics or primitive beings. Indeed, some stereotyping continues to this day. In the opening scene of the 1992 Disney film Aladdin, a little Bedouin boy in a cartoon desert happily sings, "Oh, I come from a land where they cut off your ears if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home." Such negative and distorted renderings of Arabs were misleading and damaging to any sort of rational dialogue. Moreover, these depictions bore no resemblance to the Arab people as I knew them. Where were the kind, civilized, hospitable people with whom I came into contact every day in Jordan? The Motion Picture Association had an office in Washington as well as in Los Angeles. Beyond championing the film industry worldwide, it was also a lobbying agency, and a contributor to the campaigns of several of the congressmen on Capitol Hill who challenged my husband's positions. It was also true that many of the top executives at the major studios Valenti represented were Jewish, and though they were liberal, they were deeply loyal to Israel and Israeli politics, right or wrong. Jack Valenti was very gracious when we met, and he listened attentively while I talked with him about ways to promote a more balanced portrayal of Arab culture. He let me know that my aims were commendable, but that the film industry would find them more provocative than I might suspect. To make any impact, I would need to spend a lot of time in California lobbying the studio executives, he explained. What he said made sense, but California was a long way from Jordan, and my first obligation was to my husband and family. I am tremendously encouraged to have seen some progress in changing the role of Arabs in films. I was delighted when David O. Russell's 1999 movie Three Kings, with George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, and Ice Cube, portrayed Arabs in a more humane way. And I was heartened when Jack Shaheen recently published Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People, a book that generated some media attention for the issue. In my own meetings in recent years with studio executives, producers, actors, and, most recently, board members of the American Film Institute, I have encountered a profound sensitivity to the negative impact of stereotypes, not just in the United States, but abroad, where Arabs and others see these films as lingering American biases toward the developing world. I was also encouraged to learn that the U.S. Army bought 100,000 video copies of Akkad's film The Message, about the Prophet Muhammad, to show troops preparing for service in Afghanistan. Producer-director Mustafa Akkad did a magnificent job of bringing the Prophet's life to the screen while remaining true to the Muslim belief that Muhammad himself must not be depicted in any way. The main on-camera presence is Hamza, the uncle of Muhammad, played by Anthony Quinn. State Department employees bound for the Middle East are all required to see that film, as well as Akkad's Lion of the Desert, about the 20-year-old war waged by the Bedouin to combat Italian colonization in Africa. In the crucial area of bilateral relations, the Jordanian delegation left the United States no further along than when we had arrived, but with the sense that the Carter administration had developed a deeper understanding of the issues and was open to considering some specific new proposals to break the post-Camp David stalemate. Nonetheless, it was a low period in Jordan-U.S. relations, and particularly painful for me. I was seeing the land of my birth through new eyes, and the image America was projecting was not a positive one. I had grown up believing in America's commitment to freedom, justice, and universal human rights, but Washington was not exhibiting those fundamental principles in its treatment of Jordan, a longtime friend and partner. I understood then, as I understand today, that U.S. support for Israel is long-standing and inviolable. But why did that relationship preclude other valuable perspectives on achieving the goal of peace in the Middle East? Why did it preclude Arab human rights and the implementation of international law and UN Security Council resolutions? Confronting the power of the Zionist lobby for the first time was sobering. The Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee was founded in Washington in 1980, the year of our state visit, in an effort to promote a more balanced U.S. Middle East policy and to correct anti-Arab stereotypes. But it was a rank amateur compared to groups such as the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. AIPAC's supporters were CEOs of large American corporations and representatives of the top levels of media and entertainment businesses, financial institutions, legal and medical professions, and, increasingly, the highest reaches of government. Their activism at the grassroots level was legendary. I remember hearing about a news program in the late 1980s that was planning a story critical of Israel during the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. Hundreds of telegrams poured into the studio protesting the anti-Israel bias of the program 2 hours before it was even aired. I had first learned about this bias, in the years prior to my marriage, from American correspondents covering the region. They frequently complained about writing dispatches that they considered even-handed, only to find that their editors at home had rewritten them with a pro-Israel slant. Stories casting Arabs in a positive light were greeted with muted enthusiasm, they said. This tilt was not surprising. More than any other country in the 20th century, America had witnessed the highly successful migration, integration, and assimilation of Jews from all over the world who achieved influence and power at the highest levels. And their unifying issue, whether they were politically left-wing, right-wing, or centrist, was Israel. By contrast, the Arabs in America were not united behind any one issue. 3 million strong, they came from different countries, different religions, and different cultures. Most had blended quietly into American culture and did not want to get involved in controversial issues, while others considered themselves visitors in America until the turmoil in their own countries calmed down. Political activism did not come naturally to them, and sadly this lack of cohesion hurt the Arab cause in America. In this light, it is little wonder that our first meeting with the Carters was so awkward. Our relationship would eventually become extremely warm and respectful, especially after President Carter left office. A generous spirit guides them both. Rosalynn Carter may not have known quite how to approach me, an American married to an Arab leader and living in what was then an Arab world hostile to the Camp David Accords. This was a pity, because we had much in common. I think President Carter had a difficult time understanding the reasons my husband had to withhold his support of Camp David. The president had put too much faith in Anwar Sadat's assurance that the Arabs would fall in line with him. As a result, the Carter administration had not really reached out to my husband and other moderate Arab leaders who could have made a difference. I also suspect that President Carter was even hurt on a personal level by what he viewed as my husband's recalcitrance over Camp David. This was unfortunate, because there were affinities between the two men. Both were idealistic and spiritual in their outlooks, that might have helped them bridge their differences. At the time, there was just too much outside interference. However, once he left office, President Carter became one of the most knowledgeable, sensitive, and balanced voices on our region's search for peace. His esteem in the Middle East and throughout the world has grown enormously during this time, as did my husband's admiration for him, and my own. I myself have had the great privilege of working with Rosalynn on the International Commission on Peace and Food, as well as on a global mental health initiative. We continued our official travels after returning from the United States, leaving almost immediately for state visits to France, to Austria, and again to Germany. The staff welcoming us back to Gymnich Castle near Bonn were terribly excited about Hamza, who was now setting records as the youngest visitor to official European guest houses. He was a lot more fun than the usual round of VIP guests, I suspect. They had never had an infant guest before, as would be the case when we went to France and the Soviet Union in 1982. Our second son, Hashim, was born on June 10, 1981, the day that historically marks the beginning of the Great Arab Revolt. We named him after the head of the clan of Hashim, the powerful Quraysh tribe in Mecca to which both the Prophet Muhammad and my husband belong. The family's ancestral identification as Hashemites stems from these roots. As it was my husband's great-grandfather, Sharif Hussein, who led the Great Arab Revolt, it seemed fitting to give Hashim that proud family name. His arrival was equally momentous, because it was his decision and his alone to be born on that day. All our other children would have to be induced, but Hashim took us all by surprise. Hussein had been in Aqaba hosting the final day of a visit by his close friend, the Sultan of Oman. As ever, my husband had exerted an enormous amount of nervous energy on the visit, attending to every detail. Sultan Qaboos, also a meticulous and sophisticated host, always received us in exceptional style in Oman. On this occasion, my husband stayed up until just before dawn to see his guests off, so by the time he returned to Amman he was utterly exhausted. Before we went to bed that night, Hussein took an antihistamine for his chronic sinus condition. I was having an allergic reaction to the last stages of my pregnancy, so I had turned on a humidifier to help me sleep. Naha Fakhouri, our Jordanian nurse, was sleeping in the children's wing of the house. She had come to help me prepare for the baby in the final weeks of my pregnancy, but there was no sense of urgency. I had seen the doctor that morning, and he had told me that I had at least 10 days before the baby would be born. As soon as he turned off the light, my husband fell into a deep sleep. Minutes later, I felt, for the first and only time in my life, a normal sensation of the beginning of childbirth. Hussein had been through the births of a number of children by this time, so I assumed he would know about the onset of labor. He was not much help. "I don't know," he mumbled. "Go ask Naha." I staggered from my bed to the other side of the house, where Naha was sleeping. By this time, the contractions were coming almost every minute. I was doubled over by the time I reached her. "Naha, Naha," I called. "I think my water has broken." She was sound asleep, and, thinking I was talking about the humidifier, responded groggily, "Okay, I'll come in and fill it up." "No, Naha, that's not what I mean," I said. Mercifully, Naha suddenly comprehended and called the doctor. I went back to rouse my exhausted husband and tell him that we needed to drive to the hospital. He moved out of bed so slowly that I told him I would go without him. "No, no," he said, "there is no question of that." He began walking in slow motion, shaving in slow motion, and dressing in slow motion, as I struggled to prepare myself. We finally reached the hospital only slightly ahead of the doctor, who had not had enough time to change into his scrubs. By then, my husband was wide awake, ready to greet Hashim. Naha helped out at the hospital and continued to care for the baby after I brought him home. Bringing in British and European nannies was an established custom in the family, so my hiring a Jordanian raised eyebrows among some family members. But it was thanks to Naha and successive young Jordanians that our children became naturally fluent in Arabic. The summer of 1981 was one of those periods when my husband was consumed with fears for the region. He had begun smoking after a 6-month hiatus, and it was easy to understand why. For a year we had watched the war between Iran and Iraq, Jordan's neighbor, steadily worsen. It had begun as a border dispute and a preemptive effort by Saddam Hussein to prevent the new Revolutionary Republic of Iran from exporting their revolution into the region. It had escalated into a bloody war that would last 8 years, claim more than 1 million lives, and bring the economies of both countries to a standstill. By the war's end, more money would have been sunk into the conflict than the entire Third World spent on public health in a decade. Most leaders in the Arab world and the West saw the war as essential to stopping Khomeini from exporting his brand of revolutionary politicized Islam to other countries, which is why Saddam was supported by so many in the international community. The king and Abu Shaker, then commander of the Jordanian army, went to Baghdad frequently to visit the Iraqi leader, particularly when there was a setback on the military front. The senseless tragedy of the Iran-Iraq war was laced with the hypocrisy that so often marks global politics. At the same time that the United States was punishing Jordan by withholding arms, it was also using Jordan to support Iraq, an enemy of Israel, by covertly sending weapons and intelligence through Jordan. My husband and Abu Shaker regularly received details from the U.S. military about the locations of Iranian ammunition dumps, concentrations of forces, and artillery positions facing the Iraqi front. Jordan would then funnel that information to the Iraqis, who, of course, made good use of it. At one point, Abu Shaker discovered that the Americans had also been in direct contact with the Iraqis all along, leading him to conclude that America was using Jordan simply as political cover, if needed, to hide its support of Iraq. He told the Americans to stop putting Jordan in the middle and to send their intelligence to Iraq through their own military attachés, which presumably they did. Things were almost always not what they seemed in Middle East politics. And Jordan, a small country surrounded by volatile neighbors, was always in the middle. In the early 1980s, a political settlement with Israel seemed increasingly remote. The re-election of Menachem Begin's conservative Likud party in 1981 escalated Israel's expansionist and reckless policies. Even Israel's staunchest ally, the United States, was alarmed when, in June 1981, Israel violated Iraqi airspace and bombed Iraq's nuclear reactor at Osirak. We were traveling to Aqaba at the time, and my husband noted the unusual direction of the Israeli jets, but by the time he deduced what they were up to, it was too late to intercede. Israel also bombed Beirut, and in December moved into Syrian territory and annexed the Golan Heights, once more violating UN Resolution 242. All the while, Menachem Begin continued to order more and more illegal Israeli settlements on the occupied West Bank, leading my husband to worry that the ongoing Israeli campaign to depopulate the West Bank of Palestinians would prolong the crisis by fueling extremism and sending a new and destabilizing wave of refugees into Jordan. We returned to the United States for a second state visit in November, this time to the Reagan White House. It was a time of terrible turmoil in the Middle East. Not only were Iran and Iraq still at war, but Israel was launching raid after raid against Palestinian targets in Lebanon, bombing and strafing villages along the Lebanese coast. And just weeks before our visit, Anwar Sadat had been assassinated in Egypt by fundamentalist officers in his own army. Hussein and I had been having a late lunch outside Amman when we heard the news on the radio. My husband was terribly shocked and saddened by Sadat's death, despite all the difficulties between them. My heart had gone out immediately to his wife, Jehan. I had not met her because of the Arab world's isolation from Egypt after Camp David, but I, too, was the wife of a man in a very vulnerable position as head of an Arab state opposed by various forces. Sadat's peace with Israel had inflamed the growing fundamentalist movement in Egypt, and religious extremists reviled him as a puppet of the West. Egypt's economy was also in a downturn, leaving many people without jobs and government services, and allowing the fundamentalists to gain ground by opening health clinics, religious schools, and mosques to preach against the government. Some said the fundamentalists in Egypt were funded by Iran, and others cited Libya. Regardless of the source, there was no doubt their influence was leading Egypt towards civil unrest. There was outrage from the extremists when Sadat had invited the deposed Shah of Iran to Egypt and held a state funeral for him when he died in Cairo in 1980. And fury when Sadat had made a state visit to the United States in August 1981. He had finally cracked down on the religious extremists when he returned from the United States. 2 months later, he was dead. "May I at least call Mrs. Sadat to offer my condolences?" I asked my husband that day at lunch. Given the political situation, I knew we could not travel to Egypt, and I wanted to express my heartfelt sympathy. "No," he said, "I will send condolences from both of us. If you call her, the Egyptian media will use the contact to indicate that normalization is going to take place, and that could be used against us. Although I never had a chance to console Jahan Sadat, I grieved for her. Like me, she lived with the constant fear that one of the countless threats against her husband would be acted on. And her nightmare came true. My husband wrote Mrs. Sadat a very thoughtful letter, which she included later in her memoirs. It was the only condolence she received from an Arab leader. Enmities ran so deep in our part of the world that people actually danced in the streets of Baghdad upon hearing of Sadat's violent death, and both Iran and Libya called on the people of Egypt to seize the moment of Sadat's assassination to overthrow the government and establish an Islamic state. Palestinians, too, celebrated. In their eyes, Sadat had been a traitor for having sold out their cause at Camp David. "We shake the hand that pulled the trigger," said one PLO commander in Lebanon. During our November state visit to the United States, I had accepted an invitation from my alma mater, Princeton, to address the American Whig Cleosophic Debating Society. It was to be my first speech in America, and I had spent weeks carefully crafting my remarks. We had no professional speechwriters in the royal court, although well-meaning advisers supplied Hussein with texts written in the very flowery language of Arabic speechmaking, which resonated better in Jordan than it did for Western audiences. Over the years I urged him to speak extemporaneously, a style of public address well suited to him. For myself, I felt I needed to be more studious in my approach, especially at the outset. At the dinner before the speech, I could not eat, and had to excuse myself for a few moments to calm my nerves. I was apprehensive about standing up on a podium and addressing the students and distinguished faculty of a school I had graduated from only a few years earlier. I tried to steady myself by concentrating on the reason I was there, to bridge the gulf between the Arab and American peoples. From the tenor of most of the questions that followed that speech, I need not have worried. Many were quite trivial, personal, or Princeton-oriented. "Is your husband a cottage club kind of guy?" one student asked. However, as the evening neared an end, several people lined up to read statements that amounted to screeds demonizing Arabs and distorting the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict. I was stunned and did not know how to respond. I could not take time to set straight their accounts of 50 years of history, but I also could not let their inaccurate premises go unanswered. I ended up feeling muddled and on the defensive as I struggled to articulate credible responses. I was informed later that a pro-Israeli political organization in New York had supplied the statements. The only place I ever encountered these planted distortions was Princeton. The second time, several years later, I was more confident. When my questioner read his statement and immediately started walking toward the door without waiting for an answer, everybody realized what was going on. "Are you staying or going?" I asked from the podium. "Do you want an answer or not?" The audience broke into laughter, because the speaker was so obviously a plant. But these episodes at Princeton reflected the lengths that some supporters of Israel would go to undermine any perspectives other than their own on the Middle East. For all the hard work, I enjoyed our visits to America very much, not least because they gave me rare opportunities to see my family and old friends. My mother and my father and his second wife, Allison, came to the fall 1981 state dinner at the White House, as did my sister Alexa, who was at Southern Methodist University Law School in Dallas. My brother Christian flew in from California. A lifelong musician, he had founded a pioneering music company producing software used by such artists as the Rolling Stones, Sting, U2, and Michael Jackson. He and I had been separated by geography and our various endeavors for so long that I was particularly looking forward to seeing him. There was a luncheon the next day at Blair House, given for me by Barbara Bush, to which I invited Marion Freeman, my classmate from Concord and Princeton. When we flew on to Los Angeles, I arranged lunch with my friend Sarah Pillsbury, a film producer who had won an Oscar for her first film, a dramatic short called Board and Care, played by two actors with Down syndrome. I wanted my friends to get to know my husband and to understand why I had made the choice I had. Sarah appreciated it immediately. She and her husband had dressed for lunch, thinking it would be a formal affair, but Hussein had heard of an out-of-the-way Mexican restaurant with a great reputation. Sarah would often tell the story afterward of riding with us in a full motorcade, security vans and motorcycle police and secret service, to a little hole in the wall, where my husband, as always, greeted our guests and shook hands with the restaurant staff. He thoroughly enjoyed himself, as did we all. Our next stop was Canada, where my husband wanted to touch base with Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. We were late leaving an official lunch in Houston, and further delayed by bad weather en route to Canada. But we were not overly concerned, because we had planned an informal working visit. Somewhere along the line, however, there had been a communication failure, and our first trip together to Canada was on the verge of becoming a fiasco. When we landed in Ottawa, we were surprised to be informed by our ambassador and Canadian protocol at the door of the aircraft that we had delayed the arrival ceremony for our state visit. This was the first we had heard that this was a state visit, and we were totally unprepared. Luckily, the weather was cold, so we could button our overcoats over our casual clothes for the formal welcome with full military honors. Once we arrived at the official residence, the Governor-General pointedly reminded us that we were running late and would have little time to change for the state banquet that evening. "And you will wear your tiara and decorations?" our hostess said to me when she showed us to our quarters. I explained that I did not have my tiara with me, to which she exclaimed indignantly, "What? Don't you always travel with your tiara and decorations?" I was irritated by then. "No, I don't," I said. "We rarely travel with our state regalia, except when exchanging visits with fellow monarchs." She looked horrified, and I wondered what we were getting ourselves into. We managed to make a respectable appearance at the Canadian state banquet that night, but the papers the next day were full of our rudeness for arriving so late, leaving the two of us feeling very much on the defensive. 2 days later, as we prepared for our official departure, I suffered a final indignity. I had put on a new pair of boots and was halfway down the staircase to the ground floor when I lost my footing. I slid to the bottom on my knees, landing at the feet of the stern-faced Governor-General, who was standing with his wife, my husband, and his aide-de-camp. I looked up slowly and smiled, as if to suggest that stair gymnastics were my usual mode of descent. The aide-de-camp gave me his hand and helped me up. There was a ripple of laughter, and then we carried on as if nothing had happened. Mercifully, that trip to Canada would prove to be the exception, not the rule. We would return to Canada many times over the years, and never again encounter the discomfort that marked our first trip. In fact, Canada is one of the countries for which to this day I feel the most affection and affinity, because of its progressive and humanitarian support for issues that are particularly important to me, such as global peacekeeping, refugee assistance, and the Ottawa Landmine Ban Treaty. The goodwill of the Canadians would be exhibited time and again. It would have to be. For reasons we never quite understood, we usually arrived late for our visits. My husband chose to fly the plane himself on one memorable occasion to make sure we would be punctual. But someone in our party had miscalculated the time zone changes, and we arrived an hour late again. I did not know this until I was in the shower washing my long hair, thinking I had an hour and a half to get ready, only to be told that I actually had less than half an hour. It was our fault, and we were mortified, but the Canadians were very good-natured about our recurring pattern of late arrivals, at least after the first trip together. It was my husband who was very upset. He was a perfectionist about these kinds of working and official visits, and it was beyond us why we just could not get Canada right. It was a relief to return home to Jordan, and I was looking forward to the upcoming debut of the Jerash Festival of Culture and Arts in October 1981, in the ancient city's spectacular ruins. First built in the 2nd century BC by legionaries of Alexander the Great, then rebuilt by the Romans in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD, Jerash featured two beautifully preserved Roman theaters on its excavated site, set like jewels amid broad, colonnaded streets and plazas rimmed with Ionic and Corinthian columns, massive arches, temples, and baths. I longed to bring the city's ancient splendor back to life and to restore it as a center of culture and trade. Earlier in the year, during a cultural event in an unprepossessing university gymnasium, I had suggested that our magnificent ancient amphitheaters in Amman, Jerash, and Petra could provide superior venues for such performances. Why not make use of them? We formed a steering committee consisting of Adnan Badran, the dynamic and visionary chancellor of Yarmouk University, and other Jordanian intellectuals. We decided that our first festival would feature Jordanian artists performing for a broad cross-section of our people, many of whom might begin for the first time to appreciate their rich architectural and cultural heritage. At the end of the 3-day event, we were elated by the overwhelming response. Encouraged by this success, we then began preparations for a 10-day regional festival, which would evolve into an annual event, unique in the Middle East, that would bring artists to Jordan from all around the world. I was careful to remember lessons learned from the Shiraz Festival in Iran, which made a well-intentioned effort to showcase some of the most avant-garde European and American plays and performers, but had been heavily criticized because the selections offended many people. I was hopeful that we could strike a balance between paying tribute to popular traditional Arab and Muslim art forms and introducing contemporary regional and international culture. Word about the festival spread. Thousands of people would come from all over Jordan, the Arab world, and beyond to attend subsequent Jerash festivals, which we would move to July to better accommodate the tourist season. The ancient outdoor theaters and monuments would provide extraordinary settings not only for Jordanian talent, but also for Arab and European orchestras, Chinese acrobat troupes, Shakespeare performed by the British Actors Theatre Company, Rigoletto, the first opera staged in Jordan in 1998, sung by an Italian operatic troupe, the Caracalla Dance Theatre of Lebanon, and, my husband's favorite, flamenco dancing performed by Spanish gypsies. The festival was credited with launching the extremely successful international career of Majida El Rumi, a beautiful and talented Lebanese singer who became a great favorite of Hussein's and mine. In late 1981, I received an invitation to speak at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University. If I speak at Georgetown, my remarks should be fairly substantive, given current circumstances, I told my husband, who had not been to the United States for many months and was deeply concerned about the deteriorating situation in the Middle East. He agreed that I should prepare a speech that was more policy-oriented than usual, and encouraged me to accept the invitation. We would work on the speech together, he said. What evolved was a speech I would deliver in the form of an open letter to the United States from King Hussein, along with my own perspective on the Middle East issues of the day. It would be highly controversial in some circles for the wife of a head of state, especially an Arab state, to deliver a political address, rather than focusing on more traditional subjects, such as children or culture. Hussein would even be accused of using me, but I was no puppet. He and I shared the same frustrations and the same longing for peace and stability in the region, so I would be speaking from his heart as well as mine. This was my first visit to the United States on my own since becoming queen. In my typically obsessive way of working, I rewrote the speech in my Washington hotel room until the last minute, knowing that there would be some 500 people in attendance, diplomats, professors, graduate students, and the press. I had finished polishing what must have been the 20th draft of the speech, and was dressed and ready to leave for the university, when the phone rang. "I've just realized what you're about to do, and the position I've put you in," my husband said. "I'm so nervous, I've just taken a Valium." "Thanks a lot," I laughed. "That's very comforting." As I stood before the Georgetown audience, I thought about how much effort I had put into my remarks, and that I would have only one opportunity to present them. I might as well relax and enjoy the experience, I told myself. My anxiety evaporated. In the course of my comments, I referred to the popular myth of Israel as a beacon of democracy. Drawing from recent events, I said, "Israel is a democracy in which a stone thrown by a youth at an Israeli military patrol is reason enough for that youth to be fired upon, to be summarily evicted with his or her family from their home, to have that home blown up with all their earthly belongings." I reiterated that any solution to Arab-Israeli conflict would have to be based on self-determination for the Palestinians, on respect for international law, and on repatriation or compensation for Palestinian refugees. I knew that every word, every phrase, would be parsed and potentially criticized. Any misstep on my part could be used to distort or complicate Jordan's position in the Arab world and its relations with the United States. The Washington Post sent a reporter from the Style section to cover the Georgetown speech, and once again the resulting story focused as much on what I was wearing as on what I was saying. But at least I was quoted accurately on substance. I just had to learn to live with the inevitable paragraphs about my appearance and storybook romance with my husband. As long as my message came across, I was content. From then on, there was a clear shift in what people expected of me in the public sphere. Personally, I do not think anyone in the West, journalist or not, knew what to make of me. I was an anomaly, and therefore defied easy categorization. I had been born and raised in America, to be sure, but at the same time I was now a Jordanian citizen. I was addressed as Your Majesty, and my perspective had broadened to include Arab and Muslim sensibilities. At the same time, I looked like an American, spoke like one, and understood American cultural references. I was married to a head of state who had inherited his position and his commitment to represent Jordan for a lifetime, not merely for 4 years. And so, as his wife, had I. In the fall of 1982, my husband embarked on yet another framework for peace in the Middle East, this one generated by the Reagan administration. Variations of the Reagan plan would play out over the next 6 years, alternately raising and dashing our hopes. In retrospect, I think those may have been the most frustrating years of Hussein's life. The Reagan initiative grew out of the spiraling violence in the Middle East in the early 1980s and the unchecked expansionism of Israel. In June 1982, 2 months after my speech at Georgetown, Israeli forces led by Israeli Defense Minister Ariel Sharon invaded Lebanon, leading to the prolonged bombing of Beirut and the massacre of close to 700 Palestinian men, women, and children at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. Hussein and I were sickened by the loss of life and wary of what the Israeli invasion of Lebanon foretold. Israel had invaded Lebanon before, in 1978, and my husband had taken careful note then that there had been no Arab military resistance to the invasion, which had caused some 225,000 Lebanese to flee their villages. The wave of Lebanese refugees, combined with the continuation of Israeli settlement policy, and the provocative statements coming out of the conservative government in Israel that Jordan is Palestine, convinced him that the West Bank was just as vulnerable to Israeli aggression and Palestinian flight as Lebanon, with the need for a political settlement becoming more and more urgent. When the Reagan administration secretly sent Nick Veliotis, a former ambassador to Jordan, to meet with the king and present him with a new Reagan initiative for peace, Hussein cautiously agreed to it, with the stipulation that the United States stand by its provisions. Hussein was already deeply concerned by his contacts with Reagan. Every U.S. president from Lyndon Johnson on had called the Israeli settlements on Palestinian territory either illegal or inconsistent with international law. But Reagan had not. 2 weeks after he took office in 1981, Reagan had abruptly altered American foreign policy by declaring that he disagreed with the reference to the settlements from former administrations as illegal. "They're not illegal," he said. My husband had immediately written Reagan a letter. "I am amazed you have moved into considering the settlements not illegal," it began. The so-called Reagan plan that Veliotis brought did at least call for a freeze on Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank and a return to the borders of the 1967 war in return for peace. Though it did not call for an independent Palestinian state, it did suggest that the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza would enter into a confederation with Jordan and that their final status would be negotiated with Israel by a joint Jordanian-Palestinian delegation. Assured that the United States would stand by its word this time, my husband signed on. Menachem Begin, however, did not. He immediately rejected the Reagan plan, having no intention of honoring Resolution 242. Moreover, he effectively thumbed his nose at the Reagan administration. Within a week of the announcement of the Reagan plan, Begin's government allocated more than $18 million to building three new settlements on the West Bank and approved the construction of seven others, adding to the 100 or so armed camps and 30,000 Israeli settlers already illegally in Gaza and the West Bank. Reagan responded to Begin's expansion of the settlements with mild reproof, betraying the assurances he had given to my husband that the United States would carry through on the provisions of the Reagan plan. He merely said that Begin's action was most unwelcome, and that the U.S. government would try to impress on Begin and his government how damaging the settlements are to peace. This was hardly the language my husband had agreed to in the Reagan plan, which called for the immediate adoption of a settlements freeze by Israel. Nonetheless, the king was still somewhat optimistic as he continued shuttling around the Middle East, trying to build an Arab consensus for the Reagan plan. He was disappointed when the Arab countries held a summit in Fez a week after the announcement of the Reagan plan, and instead of endorsing a Jordanian-Palestinian delegation to negotiate with Israel, reaffirmed the PLO as the sole and legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. My husband knew, and the Americans knew, that King Hussein would be an acceptable negotiating partner for both the United States and Israel, and the terrorist PLO would not. But good news also came out of the Arab summit. Not surprisingly, the Arab nations called for the right of Palestinian self-determination and the dismantling of all Israeli settlements. But for the first time, the Arab countries recognized the withdrawal of Israeli troops to the pre-1967 boundaries in Palestine as a condition for peace. And without naming Israel, they called on the UN Security Council to guarantee peace among all the states in the region. This de facto recognition of Israel was a breakthrough by the Arab countries. Now, all eyes turned to the PLO. The PLO had never recognized Resolution 242 as the basis for peace. To the hardliners, the very name of their organization, Palestine Liberation Organization, meant the liberation of all of pre-1948 Palestine, not just what was being called the occupied territories. However, the more pragmatic among them confined their rejection of Resolution 242 to the resolution's omission of the specific right of Palestinians to self-determination. King Hussein and one of his closest aides, Adnan Abu Odeh, himself from a Palestinian family, recognized a loophole in the Reagan plan that could satisfy the latter group, if not the former. Under the joint Palestinian-Jordanian Confederation called for by the Reagan plan to negotiate with Israel, the Palestinians could have de facto self-determination, and the issue would be moot. If my husband could sort that out with Yasser Arafat, peace could be achieved. Hussein came very close to achieving that breakthrough when the Palestinian National Congress agreed in February 1983 that Arafat should meet with my husband to explore the possibilities. Arafat came to Amman in April, a month I remember well because by then I was 9 months pregnant with our third child. The king spent hours with Arafat in Basman Palace in the royal compound, explaining the merits of the Reagan plan and persuading him to sign on to the joint federation. I was taking a walk in the palace compound with Leila when we saw Arafat finally leave. Hussein looked exhausted when he joined us, but he seemed to have performed a miracle. Arafat had agreed to the plan. I wondered why he did not look more triumphant, and then he explained that Arafat had agreed verbally to the plan, but, unlike my husband, had not signed it. Hussein had tried every ruse he could think of, short of locking Arafat in his office, but the PLO leader insisted that first he had to consult with his constituencies in Kuwait and the Gulf and other areas. He had given the king his solemn promise that he would return shortly to Amman with the signed document. But my husband's instincts were right. Arafat left and did not return to Jordan for more than a year. Our third baby was born 3 weeks later, on April 24, 1983, in the midst of that agonizing period. I had not planned this pregnancy at all. In fact, I had been quite desperate when I found out I was pregnant again. I had thought that perhaps 10 years from now I would have a last child. I had three boys at home, Ali, Hamza, and Hashim, all running amok through the house, full of young male energy. And then, suddenly, I was expecting again after little more than a year. I was hoping for a daughter this time, and fate smiled on me. We broke with the tradition of family names and named her Iman, which means faith in Arabic. It was simple faith that was sustaining us in the face of the trauma and suffering of so many in the region. King Hussein would need all that faith and more over the next 5 years after his talks with Arafat collapsed. All the while he would be under tremendous pressure from the United States to make a separate peace with Israel, as Sadat had done, or at least to meet with Begin face to face in Washington. He could do neither, of course. Any negotiations with Israel over the occupied Palestinian territories would have to include the Palestinians. But as a matter of policy, neither the Reagan administration nor the Israelis would meet with any member of the PLO until the Palestinians accepted Resolution 242 and recognized Israel's right to exist. So we were stalemated. Meanwhile, Congress continued to hold hostage the arms and aid Jordan needed, because my husband, in the words of APEC's spokesman, was not doing enough to enter the peace process. It is as difficult to comprehend now as it was then, the almost unbelievable disappointment and betrayal Hussein had suffered. But he never let go of his fundamental optimism, his faith in people, and his belief that by giving the best of himself, he could bring out the best in anyone or any situation. He always assumed that he was negotiating with men of goodwill, and that somehow, if he worked at it hard enough, he would be able to achieve peace and reconciliation. In this quest, he was often beset by adversaries on every side. But he never, ever stopped trying. Chapter 11. At Home and Abroad. It was a relief to everyone when we finally moved back into Al-Nadwa Palace shortly before Iman was born. For 3 years we had been living like gypsies in different houses, and all of us were looking forward to settling down. I had enlarged the original attic floor of Al-Nadwa during the renovation to accommodate our growing family, but still our quarters were cramped. With the arrival of Iman, we had 6 young children in the house.